Hi, it's Linda Holmes. Take part in NPR's continuing efforts to bring you news and stories that matter. Visit nprlistens.org to share your feedback and opinions. At nprlistens.org, you can have a say in the future of public radio. nprlistens.org. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll take a look at one of the genres that dominates every summer, the buddy movie. Bromances, cismances, or whatever we're calling all of those friendships that take over the box office. And then we'll move on to first impressions, first beats, opening scenes, and all the other beginnings that we love and love a little bit less. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Tanya Ballard Brown, what do you do at NPR?
I am an editor for our website.
Well, we are very excited. We have not had Tanya with us in a while. We always enjoy having her here.
Uh-huh.
I always want to ask you, Tanya, how is your tiny dog?
Alex is wonderful. I was gone this weekend, and he stayed with his Auntie Sharon and Cousin Puffy. Went to pick him up yesterday, and he seemed a little miffed with me because, you know, I went on an adventure that he couldn't join me on, but otherwise he's okay because I work and feed him, eat and lay down.
My cats do that exact same thing, but with diabolical vomiting. I was gone this weekend too, and there were just piles everywhere.
I'm glad I didn't come to check up on your cats.
No, my cats are nature's bastards.
Well, I'm always happy to hear about Tanya and her little tiny dog because you know what I love? Buddies. I love buddies.
See, I see what you were doing.
I love Tanya and her dog.
Radio professional.
And I love other buddies. You know, this week we've been thinking about 22 Jump Street and other, you know, they call them bromances, buddy films, buddy cop films, lady buddy films. And we wanted to talk a little bit about friendships and partnerships and sidekicks. Now, for me, one of the funny things about 22 Jump Street is that those two guys, Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill, are sort of both have interesting arcs in that they both started out as different kinds of goofy actors. And now they're back in this very goofy movie. But in the meantime, they've done Soderbergh movies and Scorsese, other high-class projects. So, you know, you get these guys who on the one hand are opposites, but on the other hand have a very similar arc that they've followed in a strange way. But they still have that fundamental opposites attracting thing that seems to be a basic part of buddy movies. Do I have that correct, Glenn Weldon?
I think so. This is a genre that's so ubiquitous and so generic that it almost sometimes doesn't get classified as a genre. People don't think of it as a genre because it is the background noise of American popular culture. It's the air we breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly when I was growing up in the 80s, the buddy cop film
was
what superhero films are now. So whenever
anybody ever,
you know, says, oh, another superhero film, I'm like, yes, exactly. Now you know what it was like for me when all we had was Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines as a mismatched pair of wisecracking cops who make their own rules.
That's true. I forgot all of Gregory Hines.
You got your 48 hours. You got
your Midnight Run.
Your Midnight Run, your Rush Hour, your...
There were so many movies where it's like, he loves dogs, she loves cats, they're detectives.
Yeah. One's a by-the-book blah, the other one's a shoot-from-the-hip maverick who makes his own book. It's just this formula that we don't notice anymore because it's all we get.
It's true. How about you, Tanya? Do you have are you a buddy cop person, buddy film person?
I've seen a few because, you know, like you say, I grew up in the 80s and Lethal Weapon 1, 2, 3, 4, 78.
Right.
You know, there were so many.
Uh-huh.
One I saw recently and I thought, why are these two people in this movie together? Is Denzel and Mark Wahlberg in Two Guns.
The bank was a setup. We got to figure out whose money that was.
Well, like we're working together?
No, not like we're working.
Yeah.
No, like we're working in the same vicinity.
Together.
In the same area code.
Together.
All
First
right.
of all, Denzel has a gold tooth, but I can't focus because why do you have this gold tooth? And then Mark Wahlberg is just Mark Wahlberg in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, like, he does tend to be Mark Wahlberg-y in many movies.
Yeah. Mark Wahlberg was also in another buddy cop film that was a spoof of buddy cop films, the whole genre, which was The Other Guys. He started with Will Ferrell in a very funny takedown of this entire genre, which by the time we get the spoof of the genre, it's time for the genre to end.
Yeah.
Let's get it.
Yes. I can see that. I mean, I think one of the things I always find interesting about kind of buddy cop movies and buddy movies is that ability, though, to tap that same dynamic over and over and over and over and over again. I mean, they've been doing opposite buddies, you know, for centuries. I mean, they've been doing opposite buddies.
The Odd Couple.
Well,
I mean, not cop movie, but they were.
No, sure. I mean, the Odd Couple is sort of it's the thing where you name the thing after the genre that it is. Uh-huh. Yeah. The Odd Couple. But they're an odd couple.
But also, like Some Like It Hot.
Oh, of course.
Yes. One of my favorite movies ever.
And Laurel and Hardy.
Right.
And Abbott and Costello.
It goes back at least to vaudeville. You have the two-person team. One's a straight man. One's the comic. And that dynamic has carried through Laurel and Hardy, as you said, Hope and Crosby, Martin and Lewis, Burns and Allen, Rowan and Martin, Smothers Brothers. Nowadays, what I find funny is, in comedy at least, that strict, they're very mismatched, two different people is kind of going away. The Sklar Brothers are basically the same guy. You know, the Concords, they don't have that straight guy comic dynamic.
Right. Yeah.
And even Garfunkel and Oates don't have that same kind of thing.
They
it
don't.
Seems like it's a relic of the past. But I understand why it happens. I mean, when Harold Ramis died, the great Harold Ramis died, Stephen Tobolowsky, who was an actor who played Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day, he wrote a piece for Slate about working with Harold Ramis, and what he said was that they were setting up the scene between Bill Murray and Stephen Tobolowsky, where he plays Ned Ryerson, and Tobolowsky went to Ramis and said, what do you want me to do? Because obviously the camera is going to be on Murray. And Ramis said to him, do whatever you want. I'm setting the camera up wide. No close-ups. Comedy only happens when there is a relationship. We'll see you both at the same time. Comedy lives in the two-shot.
Hey! Phil Connors! I thought that was you. My, oh my, Phil Connors. Now, don't you say you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
Ned Ryerson?
Bing! Oh, first shot right out of the box!
So that's what we're dealing with here. It's the action and reaction, which are equally funny. It's not like just the punchline is the thing, but what comes after the punchline is equally important. And so that's what all of these things that have two people going back and forth are kind of generating.
Right. I have not yet seen 22 Jump Street, but if you look at the 21 Jump Street movie, neither one of them is a particularly smart guy.
Right.
I mean, there's not like a smart, straight-laced. I don't remember if there was some suggestion that one of them was slightly less of a goof-off.
Yeah.
But for the most part, they're both dumb guys. They're both kind of goofballs. They're not really playing that straight guy. And if you look at a movie, even if you look at kind of bigger groups of three and four people, like the Hangover movies, you know, Ed Helms always plays the sort of straight arrow guy, but that always goes away very quickly.
Right.
And then they're all, I mean, aside from what Galifianakis is doing, which is always its own brand of weird, for the most part, a lot of that stuff could be any of those guys doing it. Part of what I think is interesting about where these buddy movies are going now is this, like, bromance idea, which I sort of have issues with.
Yeah, I mean, that may just be a sign of the times in terms of that's how these things are cast, that today it's the bromance, whereas in the past it was the buddy comedy. What I do think is interesting about this as a genre is that it's an even better test of chemistry than romance. You know, we talk all the time about, we don't, but people do, about chemistry between actors who are playing lovers in movies.
Right.
And to me, the buddy trope, the two people who are just bouncing material off of each other, who are being funny and reacting and re-reacting and re-re-reacting. A buddy movie, it's kind of the ultimate opportunity to see how these people riff. It feels so much more natural, and I think that particular setup really benefits certain kinds of actors. I mean, there's a reason Jonah Hill is in a million of these. There's a reason that Vince Vaughn is in a million of these. Vince Vaughn is particularly good at kind of, Seth Rogen is, you know, maybe the best at it in terms of doing a certain amount of monologuing, but also just reacting and bouncing and sparking.
Well,
I think Melissa McCarthy.
It's funny that you mentioned Seth Rogen, because when Glenn had just mentioned Harold Ramis, because in Knocked Up, they have a lovely scene that they play together that I think actually is some of the best chemistry in that movie.
I just don't get how I tell the kid not to do drugs when I do drugs. I'll feel like a hypocrite.
Well, remember what I told you? When you were a teenager?
What did you say?
I said, no pills, no powders.
That's right, that's right.
If it grows in the ground, it's probably okay.
I mean, I guess it worked. Like, you told me not to smoke pot all those years, and then I found out you were smoking pot that whole time.
Not the whole time, just in the evenings and all day every weekend. Not that much.
They have exactly what you're talking about. They have that kind of reacting chemistry where just the reactions to each other are funny and feel so genuine. But one of my issues with the whole bromance angle is it has that weirdly mocking tone toward guys being close friends as adults mm-hmm. that I don't think women are sort of expected to tolerate. Like, you can be women and be in, like, Fried Green Tomatoes or Thelma and Louise. I mean, not that that ends that well for them, but
Romy and Michelle's high school
movie. Yeah, I wanted to bring up Romy and Michelle.
Romy and Michelle. You can have these kind of intimate bonds of friendship without it being like, huh, it's like you're dating. Whereas bromance, it has this weird kind of, it always feels snide to me, like you're making fun of these guys for being so close to each other.
But I will take bromance any day over what we had in the 80s, which was you just waited for the homophobic joke to come in.
No,
because
right.
You couldn't have two dudes having a friendship without somebody making it clear, oh, nothing weird's going on here.
Right.
I mean, what is Bronson Pinchot as Serge doing in Beverly Hills Cop except to kind of say, oh, he's nothing crazy going on here, guys.
Right.
Let's distance ourselves from that. That's what it's for. The bromance stuff, it often strikes me as harmless.
Well, and as much as I loved Friends, but the number of sort of gay panic jokes in particularly in the Joey and Chandler thing, because they were close friends.
Yep.
Okay, look, let's talk about what a huge star I'm going to be.
You are going to be a huge star. I'm going to hug you.
You hug me.
All right.
Hey, do we do this too much?
I think so. Yeah, get off me.
Yeah.
What do you think about Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, though?
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it either.
I love that. Can you not have seen that movie? It was great.
Tell me what you like about it.
Well, first of all, it's Robert Downey Jr.
Gotcha.
Though he often dominates, it's very tricky. Yeah. He's such a capital A actor that you want him cast against an equal.
Yeah.
Who has a strong gravitational pull as well, because Robert Downey Jr. is especially given to monologuing.
Right. Well, right. Right. And, you know, Robert Downey Jr. has played a number of those kind of buddy ships through all the Avengers stuff, both with Don Cheadle.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Don Cheadle, and the other one was
the first, the second Iron Man. First,
first
Rhodey
was
Terrence Howard in the first one, and then he was Don Cheadle. Rhodey was Don Cheadle.
So that relationship, but then also in Avengers, he played a lot of scenes with Mark Ruffalo, and especially with Chris Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not friends,
mm-mm.
but they have a very, you know, a very interesting kind of pairing between the two of them. When we went to see The Heat for this show, we talked about how unusual it is to have kind of that same dynamic play out among women.
Same dynamic. I mean, like just lifted up and intentionally, of course, intentionally, but just like straight arrow and loose cannon.
Stop pulling my pants off. Jesus.
What?
What are those?
What
are those?
Stop it. These are my Spanx. They hold everything together.
Why? What's going to come popping out?
Yet done very, very effectively. I mean, I think in general, one thing that I tend to like about these movies, even though, I mean, obviously the 80s, there's tons of homophobia in a lot of the 80s buddy cop movies, the bromance thing, you know, Linda has expressed reservations. But one thing that I really love about buddy comedies is they're movies with jokes in them. And how many movies right now, particularly big movies, like, you know, we're in that summer movie season, how few of these big movies have laughs in them, and how refreshing it is to go to a movie and just laugh a whole bunch of times. And that's one reason that The Heat stood out so much, even more so than the fact that central relationship was between two women and that you could have cast male actors in those parts and had it still function the same. It had these fantastic jokes in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's true. I mean, it's one of the major populist comedy genres that has not died out.
But, I mean, it's also the dynamic that we see in every cop show, every medical examiner show, every cop movie. It's the mismatched pair. It's not just cops. I mean, Kirk and Spock are a mismatched pair.
Of course. Yes.
Because what you do is you bring two characters together and you delineate their differences. That's characterization. That's like characterization 101. And I'm not sure. There's no way to prove if this formula is familiar because it's popular or it's popular because it's familiar. I mean, it's a closed circle. But yeah, it's there's no getting away from it.
Yeah, well, and frankly, when you talk about like the bromance angle and the comparison to romantic chemistry, that whole idea of like he's a straight arrow, but he goes by the rules. Like, I mean, and you know, he's a loose cannon.
Right.
That is played out in romantic, you know, stories all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
When some, you know, woman who's a crazy, you know, she's a crazy nightclub goer. He's a straight arrow, whatever.
Well, the whole manic pixie dream girl trope is built on he's very sad, and maybe he's an aspiring screenwriter.
Yeah.
And she's the fantasy of an aspiring screenwriter.
Right? And she's all bubbly and full of energy. So that, it's like they're stressing when they say bromance that it's not romantic. It's kind of a joke to compare it to a romance. But in fact, those things are structured very much like romances. And if you look at a movie like I Love You, Man, a movie I really like a lot, which was an early user of this kind of bromance word as far as popular adoption, I think, of it. It's built very much like a romance. They meet, they're infatuated with each other.
All these things are overcoming differences. That's the arc of almost all these stories.
But it has the same feeling of kind of infatuation.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm getting at is that there is a structure between the way that Hollywood structures a buddy movie and the way that Hollywood structures a romantic movie, which is perhaps why you get this sort of funny, self-conscious, you know, in the 80s playing out as gay panic and now playing out as bromance, which is sort of embracing that, but not really, you know, embracing it, but also putting in this undertone of mockery. And I did have an exchange on Twitter with Rhea Butcher from Wham Bam Pow, who sort of was seeing it the same way that I did, that there's an undercurrent of, for her, homophobia when you talk about the word bromance and also the word girl crush, she mentioned. Because you do have that feeling that there's some kind of line that's not supposed to get crossed between a close friendship, but it's not a gay thing.
Well, there's the implied parenthetical no homo.
Yeah.
Right. Well, exactly. And it is. Yeah. Ugh, indeed. Well, we would love to hear from you. You should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us how you feel about buddy movies, buddy comedies, buddy cop shows. Is there any life left in this genre? We want to know. So the other thing, and you know, perhaps we should have flipped these topics and made this topic first, because our other topic is first impressions.
Mm.
You know, we originally were talking about this in terms of the introduction of characters and other things, but I personally do not think that you can start a discussion of first impressions except with one sound effect that to me is what first impressions are all about.
There you go.
Now that, for all of you marathon TV watchers, is the chung chung that begins every episode of Law and Order.
Mm-hmm. I bought that for my mother. There's a gavel that makes that noise.
Oh, nice. Right.
Absolutely. That is the chung chung from the beginning of Law and Order.
Is it meant to be a gavel? Is it meant to be the sound of a gavel?
I don't think it's meant to be a gavel.
I always thought
it's
it was. I always assumed it was.
They sold it as a gavel in the NBC store.
That's crazy. No, I always just assumed it was a noise to orient you, a noise to tell you where you are.
The show begins.
It immediately takes you to that place in like 1 second.
Slightly more seriously, it is true that that is a show that is very unusually structured. They don't have shots of people driving. They don't show you getting from one place to another, and they never use establishing shots, ever. That chung chung and the black screen that gives where they are, although it is part of the show's kind of look and feel, is also actually structurally important. They do use that for something, and they use that chung chung to get you from one place to another. But for me, it's also, it's the first thing you hear. It puts you in the right frame of mind.
And we were talking about this originally as opening lines.
Right. Or opening lines for characters.
Because, you know, I immediately started thinking about music, where the first thing that you say immediately orients you into a concept, you know, particularly records that hang together as a whole. I just drove for more than 36 hours in the last 3 days. If I seem a little crispy, seem a little not quite altogether there, that might be why. But one of my rituals when I drive long distances is to listen to Andrew WK's album, I Get Wet. And the first line of Andrew WK's album, I Get Wet, is, "It's time to party."
It's time to party, let's party. Hey, you with yourself and have a crazy party. Hey, you, let's party. Have a killer party and party.
And immediately, it is mission statement.
Colon, comma?
It's exclamation point, new sentence.
Oh, there you go. All right.
You know, any record or movie or TV show that announces its intentions in its opening words, I think is really cool.
How about you, Glenn? You got a favorite?
I thought about this in terms of books and short stories because, you know.
Figures.
Yeah. I mean, the first sentence is something that writers kind of obsess over. A lot of the times it just comes to you, you know, in the shower, while you're driving, while you're on the metro, or sometimes it's something you really work on. And a writer like Ron Carlson, you can tell from reading his short stories that that sentence was hewn out of stone, so it would be a thing. Because it's showy. It's dazzly. It kind of attracts attention to itself. And when I was teaching writing, I would tell young writers, you always want to try to reverse engineer awesomeness from stories. You want to look at the stories and pull them apart to try to figure out how they did what they did. But that is dangerous because first lines that call a lot of attention to themselves sometimes don't push you into the story. They make you stop and go, huh.
Can you give an example?
I can. Let's take one that is very showy. Like, it was the day my grandmother exploded. That's Ian Banks in The Crow Road. How are you not going to keep reading? What kind of monster are you? You're just going to let that go.
But it's also not just a big thicket of clauses.
Right. It's also
either.
Simple.
It's well, just grabby.
See, you can use the first sentence of a story in many different ways. You can do it to introduce the tone or the point of view of the person, the voice of the person who's talking to you. Or you can just try to intrigue somebody with something like, every summer, Lin Kong returned to Goose Village to divorce his wife, Shu Yu. That's Ha Jin's waiting. But let's go to the big ones. Let's go to the huge ones that everybody knows. Call me Ishmael, okay? Call me Ishmael for Moby Dick. What's going on there? In the first two words, you are getting another layer to the story. Because he's not saying, my name is Ishmael. He's saying, call me Ishmael. It might be his real name. Nobody in the book ever refers to him as Ishmael, but he's introducing this weird layer in two words. And then he says Ishmael. Now, Ishmael, if that's not his real name, who is Ishmael? He was the biblical character who was shunned by Abraham, by his father Abraham, sent out into the wilderness and suffered a great deal, but was also protected by God. So he's basically ruined the ending of the book in the third word of the first sentence.
Yeah.
But let's take an opening sentence like from Mrs. Dalloway, Virginia Woolf. Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself. Okay? Not showy, just a perfectly simple statement. Yet it's doing almost as much work as Call Me Ishmael because we know something about Mrs. Dalloway just from that. The fact that it's remarkable that she would remark upon it, that the narrator would remark upon the fact that she would buy the flowers herself tells us a lot about Mrs. Dalloway. Tells us that she's from a bourgeois sensibility and that the notion that she would buy flowers herself is worth commenting upon. So the point I was trying to make to the kids I was teaching is like a lot of these sentences are showy, like Nabokov wants to show you and dazzle. But somebody like Alice Munro, you wouldn't necessarily pull out her opening sentences because they're just about like getting you into it in a really way. But there's a lot of different ways to use it. Come back to me because I got more.
How about you, Tanya? First impressions. What did you think about?
I went to movies. The first thing that came to my mind was the first line that Lewis McKay, the character in Lady Sings the Blues, says to Billie Holiday, which is, you want my arm to fall off? Okay, oh my God. This is her first night at this club singing, and she's supposed to be gathering up money from people between her thighs. She doesn't want to do that because she's a lady. And the song ends, and people are booing her, and he is holding out some great big bill of money. And she finally looks up, and he's like, you want my arm to fall off? And then it's like, oh my God, you know that this is the beginning of some relationship, some grand love affair between these two people.
But it's a great line also because it's establishing a little something about...
It's giving you tone.
It's giving you tone. There's so much tone implied there. And I think, in general, that's your best kind of introduction in these situations. It's where it's saying something about the character. Another example, it's more like the tone of the movie, but I was thinking of that radio voice at the top of Do the Right Thing.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake!
I mean, that's what that movie is saying. That's the message of that movie, but it's also immediately jolting you right into the film, right into the urgency of the film.
The Godfather tells you what the movie is about in its opening line.
I believe in America.
Boom. Done. That's it. That's all you need. It's a speech about, you know, why he came to America, why he believes in America, but the film is about the corruption of the American dream, how it crumbles.
Yeah.
The very beginning of this season of Mad Men, we have Freddie Rumsen staring into the camera telling you in a very showy way by Matthew Weiner exactly what he wants you to do.
Are you ready? Because I want you to pay attention. This is the beginning of something.
Which I just love. I just love that he's saying, listen, dudes, it's been a while, but we're back.
Well, and that's a fascinating opening to that Freddie Rumsen scene, because the minute that you see it, it's so clear that something is very wrong in the sense that you would normally be getting this pitch from Don Draper, which they later sort of explain, and that turns out to have meaning as well. It's one of those things where I think part of what makes an effective opening is that later, when you look back on it, it's more significant than, or differently significant than it seemed when you first saw it. Because there are times when you see the beginning of something and it sort of seems like it's just set up, but then you get more of it. And one of the things that fascinates me a little bit is when they open a movie or a book or whatever with a chunk of something that is not necessarily the thing, that is not necessarily the main part, but there's a kind of a prologue. Mm-hmm. And the one I always think about is Speed, which has this entire central conceit of the bus, which is very simple.
Oh, yeah.
It is dumb simple in a great way, that if the bus goes below 50, it blows up.
I think it was called The Bus That Couldn't Slow Down.
So, but before you get to the bus, right, you've got this big central premise, which by the time people see the movie, most of them know that that's what the movie's about. But there's this segment at the beginning where there are these people stuck in an elevator. And what you get from the elevator sequence is you get the relationship between Keanu Reeves and Jeff Daniels as his partner. You get the way that Keanu Reeves is kind of cocky about the way that he interacts with criminals. And by the way, I recently found out from reading an oral history of Speed that Pop Quiz Hotshot came from Joss Whedon, of all people, who was doing Punch-Up. You get the way that he improvises his way through situations. You get his cleverness and the fact that he's a really good match for bad guys. But you also get tone. There's a great mix of scariness and comedy in the people who are on the elevator. You get a taste of how that movie has a very, very wry sense of humor about a lot of things, including the fact that it's going to take you into this ridiculous premise. Once you're set up with that kind of light touch of comedy, it's a lot easier to say, okay, so the premise is the thing has to keep going 50 miles an hour, it's going to blow up, because now you can swallow that premise because you've heard that opening.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're talking about is a statement of principles. This is the contract we're making with you. And
it's time to party.
It's time to party. Or Italo Calvino's If on a Winter's Night a Traveler Begins, you are about to begin reading Italo Calvino's new novel, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler.
Really?
Yeah, it's so cool. Stately, plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and razor lay crossed. That's from Ulysses. And so you're like, crossed. I wonder if there's going to be a lot of Catholic stuff in this. Turns out there is. Quite rather a lot. And also, in terms of just ballsiness, many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Orleano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice.
Oh, that's cool.
It's so cool.
It's okay until the word ice, and then it's awesome.
100 years of solitude, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You will always leave the best word for the last. That's the punch. It's, that's the secret. Mm-hmm. It's translated from the Spanish. I hope that's true in Spanish, too. But what he's doing there is saying, look at this scope. Look at how much this is the end of his life, and I'm going to show you the beginning.
Yeah.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. That is very beautiful. It might even be more beautiful than the Law and Order Chung Chung. Yeah, I like it. I like it. Well, I think this is one where we would definitely like to hear from you about your favorite beginnings, your favorite openings. Come and find us on Facebook or on the blog and tell us about your favorite openings and first impressions, and because, we always want to hear from you. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
It's always weird when what's making me happy is, some passing, some death. But at the same time, a passing like that brings out a lot of tributes.
Yeah.
And over the weekend, there were two really significant to me deaths that I hope at least cause everyone to pause and celebrate their life and work. One is obviously Casey Kasem. There's a terrific remembrance on the Monkey See blog from Kevin Smokler about Casey Kasem and what Casey Kasem, the host of American Top 40.
I really thought of you when I read that.
Yeah, boy. This piece that Kevin wrote is so similar to my experience. He has this whole thing that is not my experience about how he grew up among really cool kids. Mm-hmm. And so, like, to him, American Top 40 was the counterculture. And I thought that was such a cool construct. That was not my experience. But what was my experience was the act of sitting in one's bedroom with a spiral-bound notebook, painstakingly transcribing the American Top 40 as Casey Kasem announces it. I did the exact same thing, and unlike Kevin, I still have those notebooks where I would write down in this cursive handwriting that I barely even recognize. Who writes cursive? But in my neatest cursive handwriting, I would write out, Chicago, will you still love me? And up three places to number six, whatever.
Parentheses? Did you do the parentheses correctly?
If there were parentheses, sure, I did them.
I'm pretty sure my sister and I did that for a short time. Not for a long time, but we did it for a while.
And to me, that description rang very true for me. That was something that I exactly did, and it was a very early, very formative foray into obsessive nerddom. And my parents, who are nothing if not encouragers of that kind of nerddom, bought me a subscription to Billboard magazine, which is not an inexpensive thing to buy a 14-year-old. You talk about formative experiences. I once rode my bicycle into the back of a parked car because I was reading Billboard magazine while riding my bike, which was so stupid. Kids, don't do that.
Do you remember what you were reading? Oh, I want it to be Belle Biv DeVoe or something.
What was it? Wait, are you hating on Belle Biv DeVoe?
I'm not hating.
Okay. BBD? Okay. No.
I'm sure I was just analyzing charts or something. But Casey Kasem was the voice of that experience. And so that voice will be greatly missed. The other one, speaking of voices that will be greatly missed, that I hope didn't pass people by, is Jimmy Scott. He was 88. I got to see him live at this club in D.C., this fascinating club in D.C. called Bohemian Caverns, which is exactly what it sounds like.
A cavern.
They simulate rock formations in cement, and you go down into the bowels of this place, and you talk about a place where you can't get cell phone reception. A basement with concrete rock formations. And Jimmy Scott, he was very, very old and very, very frail. He had to be carried down the stairs. He performed in a wheelchair. He was very small and very frail. What people always remember about him, and obviously he's made some memorable appearances, he had this very androgynous voice. It wasn't just that it sounded like a woman's voice, it's that it sounded almost like it came from just another place entirely. There was this otherworldly presence about him. Let's actually hear a little bit of Jimmy Scott singing "When Did You Leave Heaven?" I fell in love with that voice a few years ago, and I hope Jimmy Scott never really took off. He was always kind of a cult figure, but I hope that in some small way his death causes people to discover and rediscover him.
Hmm. I encourage that entirely. That was on a mix that you gave me at one point that I loved instantly.
I put "When Did You Leave Heaven" on a wedding mix once.
Yes, you did.
Oh, so beautiful.
You did. It's very, very beautiful, and I agree entirely. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two puzzles that I want some help solving, both you folks in the room and you listening at home. Okay, so on Saturday at 1 o'clock, as is my damnable wont, I made a joke on Twitter. I do that. The joke was a straight up the middle bass hit. Solid joke. Not my best. Not my worst. There are certainly sweatier, hackier jokes in my repertoire.
Okay.
The joke was about How to Train Your Dragon. It reads a little something like this. How to Train Your Dragon. How to Train Your Dragon 2. Okay, your dragon really should be trained by now. Your dragon's not the problem, dude. Okay. That's it. That's the joke. As I say, B-minus. Solid B-minus joke.
That's a solid joke.
Solid.
So I tweet that at 1 o'clock on Sunday, as of now, at 7:02 p.m. on Monday. It has been retweeted 2,520 times.
What?
It has been favorited 2,491 times.
What?
I want to make it clear. This is not a humble brag. This is a brag. This is just...
Right. No, there's no humility. No humility.
So you want to know what happened?
I don't know why, and it's driving me nuts.
Someone
I have
retweeted.
No idea.
Did it get retweeted by
someone
massively famous person?
Sometimes it happens, Stephen. It's not the first time that's happened.
I mean, you're just fabulous.
No. I want help.
You're curious.
I want help figuring out the algorithm. Like, we have to have a T for timeliness, because the fact that the movie came out this weekend is a thing. B for brevity. We have to fold that into the formula. There has to be, you know, an A for attitude. Although this joke does not have a point of view.
It's strictly you just hit some right person.
And my theory, I once sent out a tweet when Amy Winehouse died. It was just scolding internet commenters or whatever. And it was basically directed at people who were like, why do you care about this person when there are, you know, starving children? And I responded to that by saying, compassion is not a finite resource. Mm-hmm. And it was retweeted for me at this time. It was a crap ton. It was retweeted like 500 times, which it's no 2004. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. But one more. Continue.
What happened? It was one of the like tweets of the day at Twitter. That Twitter had some service or some page or some dank alley of Twitter that has a scroll of kind of recommended tweets. And I think that was why. Because I also had a whole bunch of randos tweeting back at me, like yelling at me and swearing at me. And I didn't, like, why are all these people yelling at me? It was because it reached places that I don't usually reach.
I got a couple of people saying, well, it's actually a very good movie, you know, whatever. But but I think what happened, my theory is that there is this bubble around me of the people who follow me who are kind of over my crap.
Oh, God.
Who are kind of like, eh, whatever. She's a little look at the show pony going again. But it got outside of this little wall, and out there in the open sea of Twitter, there are people who retweet everything. Like, unlike my friends, everything. And they favorite. So that's a puzzle. Help me figure it out. I don't know why it happened. The other puzzle is, what was really making me happy this week was last night's episode of Game of Thrones, the season finale.
Yes.
Included a scene where the characters are beset by animated skeletons in a very Ray Harryhausen, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad way. It made me so happy. It was also, we saw the dragons. The dragons actually looked pretty good last night.
They did.
And I sat there thinking, I know why I like this, because this is just coded to my DNA. But why do normals like this the show? What is it about it? Like, this is the stuff that they have explicitly rejected for my entire life, and now all of a sudden, I knew that when I went into work today at my day job, the associate director of development, who normally talks about golf and Adam Sandler and golf movies starring Adam Sandler,
right,
would be like, hey, see, last night was great. And he was. And we talked about this incredibly nerdy thing, and I'm not trying to hold it up and saying, like, this is ours and you can't have it. I'm saying, welcome, dive in. But why?
Do you think Lord of the Rings paved the way? I mean,
I want theories on this because, you know, a friend of the show, Eric Stadnick, said, you know, there's no such thing as genre anymore. It's just entertainment. And I think that is demonstrably false. And I think there are people who reject entire swaths of entertainment. What the nerds who I've talked to for the book I'm writing have said is the medium was keeping people out, not the content, the medium. So people didn't read comic books because to read comic books was associated with something. Once we can make that into a movie, then anybody can get access to it and feel the same joy we do. Same thing with Lord of the Rings. You know, nobody would read one of those thick paperbacks, mass market paperbacks with the maps in it. Idiots. And and so they just go to see a movie. And, of course, it's a big, entertaining movie. So that's exactly what it is. But I don't know. I'd love to know. A lot of people wrote me back saying, boobs. It's because of boobs.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
but you can see boobs anywhere.
I do think maybe the fact that HBO is doing this and not it's behind that paywall, so they're doing things with it that would not happen on CBS or ABC, and so they're able to, and I didn't read the books, but I've read enough about the books to get that there are things that they're doing here that just would not be on CBS and ABC, you know, just they just could not do there, and I think that helps because they can stay a little more true, a little closer, you a little closer to the books.
I like that theory.
Maybe? Yeah,
I
think that's very possible. Very possible.
But come and tell me.
Excellent. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Tanya, what is making you happy this week?
We are coming up on the 5th anniversary of Michael Jackson's death. The fact that he is dead is not a thing to be happy about. What there is to be happy about is because of the anniversary of his death, that means there'll be lots of Michael Jackson music back-to-back parties. And so that's what I'm happy about. I'll get to go to some parties and put on my Michael Jackson t-shirt. And yes, I have a glove. Okay, I have a hat too. And I have some bedazzled sneakers. But I'm saying I could.
You would probably have those either way.
So you're looking forward to the opportunity, as we said, to celebrate your fandom and hang out with other fans.
Yes.
And go to Michael Jackson parties.
Yes.
That is awesome.
Yes.
Thank you, Tanya. Making me happy this week, a couple quick things. First of all, those of you who have heard me prattle on at great length about how much I love the Australian series Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries should know that I am extremely happy this week because they have announced a third season of Miss Fisher. The other thing is, I just have to acknowledge friend of the show, person we like, Dan Coyce, had essentially what I called his week of killing it last week. So first of all, he had a piece, this one was actually in New York Magazine, about spending an entire month without sitting down. Like, he sat down in the car when it absolutely couldn't be avoided. But he did stuff
And the toilet.
And the toilet.
The toilet.
But he talked about how, like, he didn't sit on the bed with his kids when he read to them, and he was surprised at how distancing and weird that was and how antisocial it felt not to sit down at dinner when everyone else was sitting down at dinner. It's one of those things where everybody loves these. I did this for 30 days. I did this for a year. And a lot of them are really dumb, but this one is really smart and cool. And he actually was on NPR talking about it. At one point, so we'll link to that. Also, Dan had a piece that was about biking with his father. This one was in GQ. It's this wonderful story about aging and how much he loves his dad and how great his dad is. And it's just, I loved it. I thought it was really fantastic. I could not believe those two things came out in the same week. I'm sure it's partly serendipity that they came out in the same week, but I was like, dude. Then, as if to top it off, he tweeted a very short video taken while watching Casey Musgraves with his two daughters of them sitting in the grass, tapping their feet, singing along with Follow Your Arrow.
Make lots of noise and kiss lots of boys. Kiss lots of girls. Something you're into.
And it is such a completely delightful, just little tiny snatched piece of beautiful life. And I was like, Dan is having the week of killing it. So that is the other thing making me happy this week is Dan's week of killing it. It's just super. It's all great. It's the two pieces are great. And then this video just lifted my heart and was wonderful. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. And you can follow Tanya at TBB. That's TDOUBLEB, TBB. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y, and our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, M-I-G-A-K-I. And you can follow, as always, our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thank you very much to all of you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll see you back here next week. Hi, it's Linda Holmes. Take part in NPR's continuing efforts to bring you news and stories that matter. Visit nprlistens.org to share your feedback and opinions. At nprlistens.org, you can have a say in the future of public radio. nprlistens.org.